Dear friends, it's very nice to be with you here this evening. Coming back to Nashville is like coming home. And so I see that you've done a few improvements on the homestead while I've been gone. But it's really special to be able to be with you and to share some thoughts during this visit. What I want to talk about tonight are just some thoughts about the great enterprise that we're engaged in now with the five-year plan, which, as you all know, is really just one stage. It's the current stage of the unfoldment of the Tablets of the Divine Plan, these messages that Abdu'l-Bahá sent to North America and through North America to all the Baha'is in the world, which really describe how the Baha'i faith will unfold, how it should unfold, and what our mission is as Baha'is in working toward the execution of this plan. These tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá were written in more than 90 years ago. It was 1916, 1917. And the Guardian describes some of the features. He says, this plan is divine in origin. It's guided by the explicit and repeated instructions that have flowed from the pen of the center of the covenant himself. It's energized by the all-compelling will of its author. It claims as the theater for its operation territory spread over five continents and the islands of the seven seas. This plan must continue to function ere its purpose is achieved throughout successive epochs in the course of the formative age of the Baha'i dispensation. Its divine commander is Abdu'l-Bahá. It's the mightiest plan ever generated through the creative power of the Most Great Name. It holds within it the seeds of the world's spiritual revival and ultimate redemption. This plan, the Guardian said, will increasingly be regarded as an agency designed not only for the enlargement of the limits of the faith and the multiplication of its institutions over the face of the planet, but for the acceleration and the construction and completion of the administrative framework of Baha'u'llah's embryonic order, hastening thereby the advent of that golden age which must witness the proclamation of the Most Great Peace and the unfoldment of that world civilization which is the offspring and primary purpose of that peace. Now you can see the implications of this plan. It's not simply about teaching. The Guardian explains it's really about the destiny of the human race. It's about the transformation of this world that we have here when you look out and you see various kinds of injustice, lack of peace, oppression, prejudices, extremes of wealth and poverty, all of these inequalities that Baha'u'llah talked about, and he brought his revelation to basically provide a prescription to resolve these things. But it's not enough if he just proclaims these teachings and then people look at them, they take them, they don't take them. For example, let's say I make every effort in my life to be free of racial prejudice. Well, so what? So one person makes an effort to be free of racial prejudice and that affects the lives of how many? A few people. But the world then still has this problem. The country still has the problem. The community still has the problem. Only if a groundswell of people recognize Baha'u'llah's teachings as a prescription for the remedies to these problems will we see a movement begin that can ultimately overturn these things and change this world that we have before us today into a world where his remedy is applied in action, where we learn how to translate that which hath been written into reality and action. So we have this plan given to us by Abdu'l-Bahá that tells us how to make this a reality, how to execute this effort and translate what Baha'u'llah said into the world. Now, it's not surprising then that that this is not a simple thing to do. It's not just, you know, something, a task. Abdu'l-Bahá writes a letter, the Baha'is get up, they do it, and it's done. As I read in those quotes, these are efforts that are going to go throughout the formative age of the faith. Shoghi Effendi talked about a series of plans that would go as far as the fringes of the Golden Age. So this is going to take centuries of our effort. And so we have to commit ourselves then to that enterprise that's before us. Shoghi Effendi said, "In carrying out the plans of God, we are strengthened, blessed, and purified. We attract the loving attention of Baha'u'llah. Our efforts are confirmed, and we are enabled through his power to achieve great victories for his faith." Baha'u'llah himself said, "O peoples of the earth, haste ye to do the pleasure of God, and war ye valiantly, as it behooveth you to war, for the sake of proclaiming his resistless and immovable cause." So we're called to more than just, you know, some kind of basic action. We're called upon to be spiritual warriors executing this plan, which is intended for the spiritual conquest of the planet. Abdu'l-Bahá said, "The blessed person of the Promised One is interpreted in the Holy Book as the Lord of Hosts, the heavenly armies. By heavenly armies, those souls are intended who are entirely freed from the human world, transformed into celestial spirits, and have become divine angels. Such souls are the rays of the Sun of Reality who will illumine all the continents. These souls are the armies of God and the conquerors of the East and the West. Should one of them turn his face towards some direction and summon the people to the kingdom of God, all the ideal forces and lordly confirmations will rush to support and reinforce. Singly and alone, he will attack the armies of the world, defeat the right and left wings of the hosts of all countries. This is the meaning of the hosts of God." Shoghi Effendi used similar language. He said, "The heroic band of the warriors of Baha'u'llah is battling in his name and by his aid for the purification, the unification, and the spiritualization of a morally and spiritually bankrupt society. In every continent of the globe, this mighty plan is forging ahead, gaining momentum with every passing day, tearing down barriers in all climes and amidst diverse peoples and races, widening irresistibly the scope of its beneficent operations and revealing ever more compelling signs of its inherent strength as it marches toward the spiritual conquest of the entire planet." Now, I'll come back to this theme, but I want to just outline a little bit about what our work has been over the years since Abdu'l-Bahá gave us these wonderful tablets of the divine plan. When Shoghi Effendi became guardian, he knew that a big part of his work was to execute this plan. This is what Abdu'l-Bahá gave. But he also saw that up until that point, when his ministry began, that most of the effort to try to respond to the divine plan was just initiative that was undertaken by different individuals. For example, like Martha Root. But most of the effort, Shoghi Effendi later pointed out, of people like Martha Root was lost. And the reason was, despite her great heroic acts, she was like somebody who was scattering seeds, and then there was nobody to tend those seeds, and nobody to take in the harvest. So much of what she did through all her sacrificial efforts were lost. So when Shoghi Effendi began his ministry, he saw that the first thing he had to do was concentrate on building up the administration as a framework, as a machinery to execute the teaching work. So he spent 16 years, basically, the first 16 years of his ministry, trying to teach the Baha'is how to organize themselves, what were assemblies, how do they constitute themselves. At the time of the beginning of his ministry, there were no national assemblies. He had to teach them how to have national assemblies, how to have conventions, what were the rules of Baha'i elections, and so on. So all of this was worked out by a back and forth process of the believers taking action and then receiving guidance from the guardian and then taking further action and then receiving clarification to their questions and so on until gradually this structure was raised. Then finally he was able to put in place this work for the teaching and launch the initial plan. The first 7-year plan was the first stage of the unfoldment of the divine plan. That began in 1937. But the Baha'is didn't quite know how to do all these things. There was a lot of guidance about teaching the faith, but how to do it systematically wasn't very clear. So this, right from the beginning, there was a pattern of learning in which the World Center, through the Guardian, provided guidance to the Baha'is, who then had to figure out what that guidance meant and then had to go do it in the world and then come back and get additional guidance or seek clarification if they didn't understand what they were doing. For example, we're all familiar with the concept of pioneering, for example. We understand this idea of sending a capable Baha'i to live in another place where there aren't any Baha'is, maybe to open a new country or some other territory for the faith. We understand that very well. But there was a time when that wasn't a well-understood pattern of action in the Baha'i community. For example, there's a letter from Shoghi Effendi in 1939, not so long ago, when he wrote to the Baha'is of India and Burma. And he said, "Those believers who have the means and also the capacity to teach should be encouraged, no matter how great the sacrifice involved, to settle in these virgin territories until such time as a local assembly has been constituted, or at least a firm group of believers formed that can safely and gradually evolve into a firmly organized and properly functioning local assembly. This policy of teaching by settlement, which the Guardian has also advised and indeed urged the American believers to adopt, has been proved by experience to be the most effective way of establishing the faith in new territories. And he therefore confidently recommends it for adoption by your assembly." So what had been happening before that? Well, people like Martha Root would maybe get on a boat and they would sail and they would go to one port after another and they would go and they would give meetings and they would try to find people who were interested in the faith and then they would get back on the boat and then they would sail away. Maybe they would keep up correspondence with people. Well, by 1939, this pattern of taking somebody who was capable and having them settle in a place until they could raise up an assembly was established, and now Shoghi Effendi was recommending it not only to the National Assembly of India and Burma, but also to the National Assembly in the United States. And he said that this approach was proved by experience to be the most effective way, and that's why he was recommending it to the national communities to adopt. The same concept was true with fireside teaching. Now, every Baha'i knows, all right, I should have a fireside in my home every month. I should share the faith, open up my home to people, show them hospitality and love, give them a chance to ask questions, and then I can help them resolve any questions they have and so on. And this is an effective way to teach the faith. Well, in 1955, Shoghi Effendi wrote, "It has been found over the entire world that the most effective method of teaching the faith is the fireside meeting in the home. This method is far more effective than advertising in newspapers, public lectures, and so on. The Guardian is encouraging the believers over the world, including those on the home fronts, to engage in this method of teaching." So again, what happened? Well, how did people teach the faith? They advertised in newspapers, it says here. They gave public lectures. Then somebody had this idea, well, why don't I invite people to my home and so on. And then they did that. And then it proved to be effective. And then Shoghi Effendi found out about it. And then he encouraged everybody to do it. So this process, it's not that all this guidance of how you make a new civilization is in the revelation like some kind of recipe or cookbook. And then if you just follow and put the ingredients in step by step, then out comes divine civilization. It doesn't work that way. Not only does it not work that way for that big picture, it doesn't even work that way for little things, like what's the most effective way to spread the faith to a new place? Well, there's no recipe in there. There's general guidance, there's principles, there's methods like consultation, and then we have to learn how to put that guidance into action under the direction of the center of the faith. And then when we find ways that prove to be effective, then those ways are, other Baha'is in the world are encouraged to adopt those approaches. Now, Shoghi Effendi, like I said, when he began, there wasn't even one national spiritual assembly in the world. The Baha'is didn't know how to have plans. They didn't know how to have systematic action. Slowly but surely, he taught them how to do that. So that in 1953, he was able to take the 12 national assemblies that existed in the world at that point and combine them into the first international plan, the first global plan, which was the 10-year crusade. That was in 1953. Now, in the first year of that plan, where all the communities were brought together to work together, 100 countries and territories were opened up to the faith in the first year of that plan. So that means that more countries and territories were opened in 1 year than were opened in more than a century before that. So that's the power of systematic action, because the Baha'is knew what to do, because they had the machinery, because they had the tested, proven methods. They could accomplish more in 1 year than they did in more than 100 years. And the same thing, over the course of that 10-year crusade, by the end, there were something like 54, 56, I'm not quite sure, national spiritual assemblies in the world. At the beginning, 12, all right? So that meant for more than a century since the Bab came, it took more than a century to get 12 national spiritual assemblies. And then in 10-year period, there were another 42, 44 national assemblies formed in 10 years. So because of this capacity to learn how to translate the teachings into action, into proven and effective patterns under the direction of the center of the faith, the Baha'is were able to accomplish much, much more through this systematic action. Now, of course, that's what we're doing ourselves in the work that we're engaged in now with the plan. At one point, near the end of Shoghi Effendi's lifetime, suddenly people started to become Baha'is very rapidly. Shoghi Effendi talked about the fact that the growth of the faith would go through three stages. He said, first, a steady flow of fresh recruits. Then an entry by troops, which was talked about by Abdul Baha, which would a more rapid entry of people into the faith. And then that would be followed after some series of events that took place in the world by a mass conversion of people. Now, this mass conversion is not really within our hands, but the House of Justice said this entry by troop stage is in our hands. And this process began even during the lifetime of Shoghi Effendi, and we saw in country after country how maybe hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people would become Baha'is. But then we didn't know what to do with them once they became Baha'is. So the process would take off, and then it would come to a halt because we weren't able to sustain it. We didn't know what we were doing. Now, we followed that pattern for something like 40 years. Start, stop, start, stop. At one point, just before the Holy Year in 92, we had a 2-year period where 1 million people became Baha'is. We went from more than 4 million to 5 million in 2 years. But again, well, we didn't know what to do with all of those people. So we hadn't learned. We hadn't proven through our action and reflection some pattern that would be effective in handling so many people. So the process came to a halt. And then in 1996, the House of Justice said, no, we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again. We need to become more conscious of this learning process. We had to become more systematic in our action. Now, what they did was put into place a pattern of activity where we could learn how to become more effective in this process of large-scale growth over time. They also focused on the development through the Training Institute of human resources, more and more workers from among the new believers who would also be capable of carrying out this work. Now, in doing this, they weren't inventing something new. These go back to statements of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá themselves. For example, there's one passage from Baha'u'llah, which is just recently translated. He said, "How many the lands that remain untilled and uncultivated, and how many the lands that were tilled and cultivated and yet remained without water, and how many the lands which, when the hour of the harvest arrived, no harvester came forth to reap them. However, through the wonders of God's favor and the revelations of His loving kindness, we cherish the hope that souls who are the embodiments of heavenly virtue may appear and busy themselves with teaching the cause of God and training all who dwell on earth." So Baha'u'llah's statement, in a certain sense, he looks at different areas of the world. And he says, look, they're in different conditions. Here's one, all right, it's barren. There's nobody to work it. Here's another one. Something's growing, but it remains without water, so it's going to perish. Here's another one. It's ready for harvest. So he sees different conditions in different places, just like we see different conditions in different places in these various clusters that we're working with now. So in those different places, we need workers. And in those different places, we have to diagnose the condition, and we have to figure out what to do. The same thing in a passage from Abdu'l-Bahá. He talks again and again about the need for teachers to arise. He says, "The thirsty ones are many, yet the cupbearers are few." And also he says, "The seekers abound, but the teachers are scarce." And again, "The thirsty ones are there in troops, yet the guides of the true path are scarce indeed." And finally, "At present, few indeed are the teachers of the cause. And so from every side the cry is raised, whither are the teachers? Whither are the teachers? No solution is there to this save the establishment of a gathering in each town for instructing the believers in teaching the cause of God. Perchance the children of the Abha paradise, who are filled with yearning, longing, excitement, and enthusiasm, could study the skills of teaching. If this is done in a proper and befitting manner, in a short while in every town there shall appear perfect teachers and steadfast orators of the cause." So here we have specifically examples of from Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá calling us to responsibilities that we're struggling to fulfill right now in our work in this plan and the systematic action that we've been engaged in since 1996, to try to learn how to raise up thousands and thousands of believers who can become effective and work in these various regions and develop a systematic pattern of action. So not only can we introduce the faith to thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, but also once we do that, we're also able to sustain the process. Now, in a certain sense, the House of Justice, through the series of plans, has established a 25-year period from 1996 when the four-year plan began, and then they said through a series of plans leading all the way up to the year 2021, which is the end of the first century of the formative age, 100 years after the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá, 100 years from the time when Shoghi Effendi took up the task to figure out how to become more systematic in the execution of the divine plan. In a certain sense, last 25 years of this 100-year period, all with a single focus, which is how to advance the process of entry by troops. That's what we're learning how to do. Now, one reason for such a period of time is, well, it's a difficult thing. It's not something we can do easily. Just like, in a certain sense, this learning process that unfolded under the direction of the guardian, the challenge is now that we consciously engage in this learning process all over the world, in whatever cluster we live in, and try to see how do we take this guidance and direction that's coming from the World Center of the Faith, along with all the writings of Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l-Bahá, and Shoghi Effendi about teaching, and how do we translate it into practical patterns of action that can prove by experience to be effective. And then when we prove that they are effective, then we can adopt them all over the world. That's basically what we've been doing. We've now been doing this for 12 years. This is the 13th year. So we're right at the midpoint of this 25-year period. And we've accomplished a great deal in the past 12 years. Remember, at the beginning, where were we? Well, not very far. We were going around in circles in a certain sense, continually repeating the pattern of bringing a lot of people into the faith and then not having enough children's classes, not being able to establish local assemblies, not being able to deepen people, and so on. So lots of people would come in and lots of people would go right back out. So we've been focused on learning about this. What have we learned? Well, we've learned how to establish now. We have a number of clusters in the world, something like 600 clusters in the world, that have at least established some pattern of growth and have been able to sustain it over a period of time. Now, there's 17,000 of these clusters in the world, so 600 is not a lot. And out of those 600, many are struggling with different problems. But unlike the previous 40 years before 1996, when we didn't see any proven systematic pattern of action, now we're seeing that pattern established. Now, what are some of the things that we've learned? For example, in 1996, the House of Justice talked about the fact that if we're going to sustain the process, then we need institute courses that would develop human resources from among the new believers and also from the old believers, because we needed more workers. Before, the problem was a small number of workers would do a lot of teaching, but then when they were overwhelmed by all of the receptivity, the whole thing would collapse. Now, only if you make more workers can you sustain it. So the House of Justice called for training institutes, and they said offer those courses at a central location and at a distance. All right, well, people knew what does it mean to offer a course at a central location. But they didn't know what it meant to offer a course at a distance. So what happened? Different countries did different things. Most of them didn't work. In one place, they came across the idea of a study circle. They thought, well, if you get a small group of people, if they have a tutor, they can study these courses after work or on weekends or something like that. And that proved by experience to be effective. So 2 years later, the House of Justice was able to point to that and say study circles should become a part of the fixed pattern of the plans everywhere. So that became part of our activity. Before 1998, we didn't know it. Now, 2 years after the start of the plan, this had developed into a pattern. Now, again, we all know it. We all have such patterns of activity in our own communities. Another example. We had, for example, this idea of core activities, which is study circles, children's classes, devotional meetings. Now, when the House of Justice first talked about these, they talked about them as the pattern of community building. Because you think, here we are, we're a religious community. What does it mean to be a community? What does our collective life look like? Well, we pray together. We study the writings together. We educate our children. So, of course, this is a fundamental part of our community building, all connected around the Word of God. We use the Word of God to pray. We study. We educate our children in the Word of God. That's the basis of community building, and that's the way it was presented to us initially. Well, what happened was we were also encouraged to open those patterns of activity up to everybody instead of just being like, you know, Baha'i Church where we do these meetings for ourselves. Baha'u'llah didn't come just to establish one more church, you know, in the community. He came to create this spiritual movement which would change the world. So these meetings should be opened up to everybody. Now, as soon as the Baha'is started doing that, they found out that a lot of people liked it very much. They enjoyed coming and praying using Baha'u'llah's prayers. They enjoyed studying with Baha'is some of the quotations from the writings in these various courses. They wanted their children to attend. Even if some liked it and even wanted to become Baha'is. But some didn't want to become Baha'is, but they still saw the value of it in their own spiritual life and in the life of their children, so they wanted to participate. So this then, in a short period of time, this went from an activity that was initially designed as a pattern of our own community building and became effective patterns for portals for growth. So the House of Justice encouraged more and more communities to adopt this pattern and learn how to integrate these patterns of activity. So from our teaching, our child education, our institute courses, all of these could be woven together, and we could appreciate the coherence of all these elements in creating a pattern where people could learn about the faith, be attracted to it, become deepened in it, maybe embrace it, and then arise on their own part to become executors of this plan. And this began with a simple identification of a few elements which grew into this coherent pattern of life that affected neighborhoods and communities. Another example of this learning was the concept of the intensive program of growth. After the four-year plan, when the 12-month plan began, we had the training institute established, but then we didn't know now how to put the training and the teaching work together. So we had to experiment with that. So then we had these area growth programs in the 12-month plan, which is about 27 places in the world, just 27 places out of the thousands of places in the world, and tried to do some pattern of combining this teaching and training to sustain growth. Well, a lot of different things were learned. None of these experiences were successful in their own right. But each one taught us some lessons about what worked and what didn't work. For example, in one of these areas, they picked a couple of villages, and they said, well, we'll have our growth program in these villages. But then when they started the process, they saw that, well, most of the people in the villages were already Baha'is. And the people who weren't Baha'is weren't interested in becoming Baha'is. So there wasn't much of a growth program. It pretty much ended as soon as it began. In another place, the area they identified was too big. So the Baha'is were few and scattered, and then the distances were so great they could never get together. So lessons like these, the House of Justice was able to draw from those lessons and then apply it in the five-year plan, the first five-year plan, when they identified prerequisites for intensive programs of growth. They talked about some of the elements, the idea of cluster, in which a region would be not too big but not too small, that would be the target for this growth program. All of these things were learned through the experience of 27 efforts that didn't really bear any fruit. But all of these elements then went into the features of an intensive program of growth. Now, another thing is that you notice that at the beginning of that first plan, a five-year plan in 2001, the House of Justice couldn't describe what an intensive program of growth was. It just talked about it in terms of these prerequisites and features. Then the Baha'is went out and tried to do this. All right, you need a balance of expansion and consolidation. You need a group of communities that are ready to that have some experience with growth. You need a core group of people who are ready to take on the challenge of growth and so on. So in different places in the world, people did different things. Until finally, 3 years later in 2004, the first intensive program of growth began in one community. And then the pattern became clear. You need 3-month cycle of activity. It begins with reflection and planning on your previous action. Then you make a plan. You have a reflection meeting where the friends participate in this learning process. They then have an intensive teaching phase, and then that's followed by a consolidation phase, which also includes teaching. Now, by the end of the 5-year plan, the House of Justice was able to introduce at the start of the second 5-year plan this whole pattern of activity and explain it in detail. It's like this, it's like that. It has a 3-monthly cycle and so on. And then called for the Baha'i world to establish 1,500, at least 1,500 clusters like that. Now, wouldn't it have been easier if in 2001 the House of Justice just explained all of this to us. In other words, what they wrote in 2005, couldn't they just write that in 2001 and save us all this trouble and effort, and then we would know what an intensive program of growth, and we would just go and do it? But the point is, they can't do that. It's not possible to do that. That's not the way that guidance works. What happens is that we have to go take that guidance and go work and put it into action and prove what's effective. And then when you see what the effective pattern is, then the House of Justice can then guide the world, do it like that. That worked. You know, this is proven by experience to be effective. Let's do more of that. So this pattern of activity where we take the guidance, try to translate it into action, in many places it doesn't work. In a few places, it does work. Then that pattern that does work can be adopted by everybody. And that's how we advance. So this is the learning that has been taking place over the past 12 years. And it's now proven itself to be very effective. We've had learning along the lines of what is a tutor. For example, at the beginning, we used to have a lot of courses. And the idea of delivering courses, the tutor was the one who delivered the courses. But then we saw people would take a lot of courses, but then they didn't carry out any action. Then we learned that, no, a tutor is somebody who accompanies people into the field of action. So you study, but you also learn how to translate what you're studying into a pattern of activity. And the tutor is somebody who did it before and made mistakes and struggled themselves. Now they're going to help other people do that. We learned about what the role of the institutions are, how local assemblies can support cluster activities. And we learned how to raise up certain agencies at the cluster level, the institute coordinators, the area teaching committee, and so on. All these were learned by experience. The idea of regional councils came into being in 97. Then we had to learn, well, how does a regional council help with the execution of the plan? And so different patterns of activity changed. So these were all effective experiences in learning. And this is how, in a certain sense, this pattern of learning is the pattern that will continue for 1,000 years. Right now, we're focusing on the idea of learning about growth. But then we'll have other problems to look at the future, like education, like creating a new economic system. Well, again, there's no formula for these things in the teachings. We're going to have to learn how to translate what's written into reality through action and then reflection on action and making lots of mistakes and gradually improving on over time until we come up with some proven patterns that work. And then those patterns can be spread to other parts of the world. Now, it's hard for us sometimes to become comfortable with the idea of making mistakes. We don't like to make mistakes. You know, you go to school and you do everything you can not to make any mistakes. You know, you want to get 100% on your test and you don't want to get any wrong answers. But in a certain sense, this idea has blinded us to what learning is really about. Because you're not really learning anything in those cases. Somebody else learned it. Now you're kind of memorizing what they learned, you see. The real learning takes place through lots of mistakes. Like, for example, you look at what a scientist does, for example. They make so many mistakes, they called it experiments, in order to cover up the fact that they're making so many mistakes. So you do it and you do it and you do it until it proves to be effective. Then that's your discovery, you see. That's what's proven. You take the idea, for example, of a young baby, all right? Baby stands up, takes its first step, and then falls down, right? So what do the parents do? You know, they throw that baby out, it's defective, we need a new baby because it doesn't know how to walk. No, it doesn't do that. The parents celebrate, you know, they pull out the video camera. They send the video up to YouTube so the grandparents can see the baby taking its first step and falling down. So we have to recognize the fact that learning involves making mistakes. And we shouldn't be upset with each other because somehow we can't execute this thing perfectly the first time. It's absolutely impossible to do that. And then we have to realize that, well, having different points of view and not being clear, and here's the guidance, but we don't know quite what that looks like in reality, and maybe we have a number of different views. It hasn't proven itself effective anywhere. So why do we have to then argue and say, I think it should be A. No, I think it should be B. No, I think it should be C. Actually, we should try A and B and C and see which one works. You see, we don't have to debate and argue and try to convince everybody they should do it the way I think. Until we actually prove it somewhere, well, we don't know. So let's do a devotional meeting like this and one like that and one like that, and let's see what's attractive to people and where they come. Finally, if they come to Group C's form of devotional meeting, why would we keep doing A and B over and over again and it doesn't work? When C has a pattern that works, now we'll learn how did they do it, and then everybody will do it that way, and it'll prove itself to be effective. So there were many things that happened during the same period of time where we made a lot of mistakes, and we had problems, and we faced challenges. For example, there was the idea, well, when the idea of study circles first came up, it was a method for the Institute in order to develop human resources. Then we found that some people who weren't Baha'is would like to come to these study circles and study with the Baha'is. They like the idea that, all right, we're all studying together, we're all the same, we read a quote, we talk about what it means, and so on. So they felt that they were studying along with the Baha'is rather than being the focus of attention. They liked that. So then we got the idea, well, this is an effective way to teach some people. So then somehow the word got out that, well, now we should just have study circles, and now we should no longer have firesides. The only way to teach is to bring people to study circles. Well, of course, the House of Justice never said that. In fact, the House of Justice said the opposite. But the Friends concluded that in some places, and then people debated it a little bit, just a little. And then some asked the House of Justice questions. Then the House of Justice could explain. Then people could see, no, of course, you continue to teach the faith by many methods, including firesides. And also, if some people would like to come to study circles, yes, they can do that too. So the whole idea of either or didn't exist at all. Another thing is, at one point, we saw that as the number of people who would study the Institute courses would grow in number and prove to be more effective over, you know, in terms of action. So we encouraged larger numbers of people to take the Institute courses, try to get 40 or 50 people through the sequence of courses. So people thought, okay, if that's the goal, we want to get 40 or 50 people through the courses. Well, it goes so slow when you get bogged down in actually doing these activities, you know, like sharing a prayer with somebody or visiting somebody's home or trying to teach a children's class. So let's just drop these parts out, and then people can go through the courses much more quickly, which then they did. But then, of course, then they would get 30, 40, 50 people through the sequence, and then they would look around, and then they would wonder, well, why don't we have entry by troops yet? We have 50 people through the sequence of courses. But then you look around and say, well, since you cut out all the practices, you're not doing anything. You're just studying some courses, and then you're going home, and then you're wondering why everybody is not attracted to the faith. So then we made that mistake, then we had to go back, and then we had to correct it. So these mistakes are happening all the time. In a certain sense, every time you learn how to solve a problem and make an advance, that introduces new problems and new challenges at which we make mistakes because we don't know what to do next. So we should recognize the fact that it's natural. Our progress is that we have problems, but they're not the same problems we had before. We solve those problems, now we have new ones. That's progress. Not progress is the same problem over and over again. But there's no such thing as progress that means escaping from problems. Now, in the past year, we've seen a tremendous learning in the area of teaching the faith. A lot of these clusters where a very good pattern of action was established, we found out we struggled with the idea of how to grow. You know, we would have core activities, people would come, but not a lot of people were becoming Baha'is. So in the second year of the plan, last year, 2007, 2008, there was a lot of intensive learning about growth, about actual expansion. And a few things were learned. One was this idea of teaching the faith directly, kind of the example in Anna's presentation, but not literally following that necessarily, but the idea of speaking directly about Baha'u'llah rather than about all kinds of principles and things, but to come out directly and tell people who is Baha'u'llah, what did he teach, and give people a sense that they might be interested in embracing his faith and putting his teachings into action as well. This proved to be very effective. Another thing, another pattern that proved to be effective was the idea of sending resource people. So from one cluster where there was growth and there was effective action, somebody could be sent to another place where they were working hard, but they couldn't quite figure out how to get growth. So this person would go, share what they were doing, a few changes in the action, and then that cluster proved to be very effective. And finally, there was a third element where this idea of the intensive teaching phase that was part of the intensive program of growth, generally what was happening in most places were at the reflection meeting, somebody would get up and give a talk and encourage everybody and say, this is our intensive teaching phase, and kind of encourage everybody to be intensive during that 2 weeks. And then, of course, it wasn't very intensive. So the idea was, well, why don't we have a collective project? Besides whatever people do individually, we'll also have a collective project and we'll focus on a receptive population and we'll try to focus on teaching that population during that period of time. That proved to be very effective. So over from three cycles of that year, that second year of the plan, we saw a few little experiments in Africa and so on, gradually spread very quickly to all parts of the world, so that in three cycles we saw a few ideas planted out there, totally blossomed, and we saw a transformation of teaching in hundreds of clusters around the world. For example, in Pakistan, in the first year of the plan, there were something like 50, 60 new Baha'is. In the second year of the plan, there were more than 1,000. Philippines also had 1,000. In a number of clusters throughout Latin America, they went to Colombia to experience what they were doing there in their successful cluster. The people went back, and they had almost no enrollments in those clusters. In the next cycle, they had 30, 40, 50 new Baha'is in all of these clusters across Latin America. So in a period of just three cycles, we went from mostly not knowing what we were doing with growth, having only few clusters that showed signs of growth, to having clusters almost universally, wherever this new strategy was put into place, showing signs of progress. And in that second year of the plan, we doubled the number of enrollments over the first year of the plan. And in places, that's not just in very receptive places where they maybe had 100 or more new Baha'is in a cycle, but also now in places we're seeing, like Stockholm, for example, 7 new Baha'is in one cycle, when for years they didn't see, altogether, they didn't see 7 new Baha'is added together. So this process of learning proved itself to be effective. And what we learned was also not just how to become more effective at growth. We saw that the basic pattern of how to move a cluster along was basically the same, whether it was an intensive program of growth or it was a place where you had only one Baha'i. Basically, you needed a cycle of activity. You needed to reflect. You needed to have some intensive teaching activity. And then you needed to follow that with a consolidation through the core activities and so on. And that pattern has now rapidly accelerated the movement of clusters from C to B to A. Basically, people are all doing the same thing. It's just that in a C cluster, there's fewer of them doing it. And then at a certain point when enough people are doing it, now you have an intensive program of growth. So all of these things have shown great significant breakthroughs. But at the same time, problems have arisen. Now, in some places, you have so many enrollments Now, are you able to consolidate successfully? In other words, are you getting so swept up now in this experience of enrolling new believers that you fail to train and raise up workers from the new population? That's potentially one pitfall. Another pitfall, suddenly people start having debates. Now we have some new methods of teaching, some door-to-door or other approaches to receptive populations. Now people say, well, unless you're doing this, then you're not really teaching the faith and you're not participating in the intensive program of growth. So that same pattern between study circles and firesides, now we're having it with door-to-door teaching and study circles or firesides and every other method of teaching. Again, a false dichotomy about our methods of teaching. Because one way proves to be effective doesn't mean we should drop other patterns of being effective. Or we lose fact. Our strategy is to develop the whole cluster. So what we have are Baha'is who live throughout this cluster developing core activities wherever they live. Now we identify one neighborhood where we can draw some believers from all over the cluster and have a lot of success in that one neighborhood. But that doesn't mean we drop all the activity in all the other neighborhoods, you see? Because now if I have a junior youth group in some neighborhood, but it's not the neighborhood, well, that doesn't count anymore. Now, only if you have a junior youth group in that neighborhood does it count, you see? Again, we're creating, but these are natural. They're problems. They're misunderstandings. Gradually, you know, it's the baby walking and falling down. We shouldn't be upset. Gradually, we'll work it out and see that the pattern is ultimately to develop such activity throughout the entire cluster. Also, this idea of door-to-door teaching. Once you establish growth in a particular receptive neighborhood, it looks like maybe you do that a couple cycles, at least in some places. Now, the third cycle, they don't have to go back door-to-door teaching because they have so many contacts. They have so many people who've become Baha'is or who are participating in core activities, and so they can sustain growth by other methods, reaching the friends, families, and co-workers of those new believers who themselves are also arising to become effective teachers of the faith. So this is our status. This is the activities that we're engaged in. And gradually now, you see we're going to be facing new challenges as we go ahead. For example, in the 2008 Rizvan message, you saw this passage from the House of Justice where they said, as you continue to labor in your clusters, you will be drawn further and further into the life of society around you and will be challenged to extend the process of systematic learning in which you are engaged to encompass a growing range of human endeavors. In the approaches you take, the methods you adopt, and the instruments you employ, you will need to achieve the same degree of coherence that characterizes the patterns of growth presently underway. So what this is pointing to is the fact that the idea is not growth as an end in itself. So in some cluster somewhere where we have a few thousand Baha'is now, we only had maybe a few dozen before, now we have a few thousand, well, it doesn't mean that the next step is just to get a few thousand more and then a few thousand more. Now these Baha'is who are there have to think, what does it mean to be a Baha'i? Something should change. My life shouldn't be the same. I have to look at Baha'u'llah's teachings and look at my family, my community, my personal life, and see how do I put these teachings into action to change what I am and what my community is and what my family is. So in areas like social and economic development, in a greater involvement with society, participating in the discourse of the people of that cluster about what their problems and challenges are, and seeing how Baha'u'llah's teachings might help them solve some of those problems. In our administrative work, in our activities for any of these elements, we have to learn how to now take this element of growth, which has become strong, and weave it together with all of these other elements, not only to build up the Baha'i community, but to make the Baha'i community an effective agent in transforming that community, in transforming that cluster. First transforming ourselves, but then participating in a process of transformation that gradually, step by step, little by little, will start to change the world from the way it is to one that reflects more and more of the qualities that Baha'u'llah is trying to cultivate. Now, I wanted to just conclude by going back to this initial idea when I was quoting about this idea of the spiritual conquest of the planet and the Lord of hosts and the heavenly armies and so on. It might seem odd to us when we say that, well, Baha'u'llah has come to build a world of peace and justice and so on, that you start using war terminology. Why all this armies and fighting and conquest and so on? But if we think about it, what's being talked about here is really an existential issue, life and death. It's critical. It's something that's worth sacrificing for. It's about way of life. It's about well-being of humanity. It's about the kinds of things that people are willing even to give up their life for. So this is the theme that is brought in this idea of becoming spiritual warriors. Baha'u'llah has diagnosed the world. He says, ever since the seeking of preference and distinction came into play, the world has been laid waste. It hath become desolate. So people want to advance themselves over their neighbors. Their group, their community is better, superior to others. They want to exert power. They want to take benefits for themselves and so on. Ever since that has come into play, it has destroyed the well-being of the world. And Baha'u'llah's prescription for that is he says, blessed is he who preferreth his brother before himself. In other words, not just treat other people the way you want to be treated. Prefer your brother before yourself, the opposite of this problem. And so what Baha'u'llah is trying to do, he sees this problem in the world, and then he sees that he has to raise a community of people who will not seek their own self-interest, who will put others before themselves, who won't come with an agenda for the world. Baha'is want this, Baha'is want that. But Baha'is will not want anything for themselves, but will want the betterment of the world and will act and be willing to sacrifice themselves to achieve that change in the world. Now, this is why, in a certain sense, we come to this terminology. And then we see what is meant by this idea of war. It doesn't mean fighting a battle. It means serving humanity. Baha'u'llah said, we have decreed that war shall be waged in the path of God with the armies of wisdom and utterance and of a goodly character and praiseworthy deeds. All right, not with swords and guns, with good character and praiseworthy deeds. The things he hath reserved for himself are the cities of men's hearts, that he may cleanse them from all earthly defilements and enable them to draw nigh unto the hallowed spot which the hands of the infidel can never profane. Open, O people, he says, the city of the human heart with the key of your utterance. And Abdul Baha says, to do battle doth not, in this greatest of all dispensations, mean to go forth with sword and spear, with lance and piercing arrow, but rather weaponed with pure intent, with righteous motives, with counsels helpful and effective, with godly attributes, with deeds pleasing to the Almighty, with the qualities of heaven. It signifieth education for all mankind, guidance for all men, the spreading far and wide of the sweet savors of the Spirit, the promulgation of God's proofs, the setting forth of arguments conclusive and divine, the doing of charitable deeds. So these are the efforts. This is the way you do battle in this dispensation. But it takes people who are willing to sacrifice themselves. Consider some of these statements, which you all know very well, which come from Abdul Baha. Be ye the helpers of every victim of oppression, the patrons of this of the disadvantaged. Think ye at all times of rendering some service to every member of the human race. Baha'is must be distinguished from others of humanity, but this distinction must not be depend upon wealth, that they should become more affluent than other people. I do not desire for you financial distinction. It is not an ordinary distinction I desire, not scientific, commercial, industrial distinction. For you, I desire spiritual distinction. In brief, you must become distinguished in all the virtues of the human world, for faithfulness and sincerity, for justice and fidelity, for firmness and steadfastness, for philanthropic deeds and service to the human world, for love toward every human being, for unity and accord with all people, for removing prejudices and promoting international peace. Again, he says, we should be continually be establishing new bases for human happiness and creating and promoting new instrumentalities toward this end. How excellent, how honorable is man if he arises to fulfill his responsibilities? How wretched and contemptible if he shuts his eyes to the welfare of society and wastes his precious life in pursuing his own selfish interests and personal advantages. And finally, he says, let your actions cry aloud to the world that you are indeed Baha'is, for it is actions that speak to the world and are the cause of the progress of humanity. If we are true Baha'is, speech is not needed. Our actions will help on the world, will spread civilization, will help the progress of science, and cause the arts to develop. Without action, nothing in the material world can be accomplished. Neither can words unaided advance a man in the spiritual kingdom. It is not through lip service only that the elect of God have attained to holiness, but by patient lives of active service have they brought light into this world. This is the work of a true Baha'i, and this is what is expected of him. If we strive to do this, then we are true Baha'is. But if we neglect it, we are not followers of the light, and we have no right to this name. Now, friends, this is not obviously an easy task. This is something we struggle with. We basically struggle to respond to Baha'u'llah's call to self-sacrifice, so that we can be these agents, be this leaven that operates in the world. Not that the Baha'is are going to do everything. Not that we're going to solve all these problems. All humanity participates in this change. But we have to commit ourselves and sacrifice ourselves and become something different as individuals and as a community to play this part. When Shoghi Effendi took on this burden the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá, and then realized that he had this responsibility to be the head of the faith, to execute the divine plan, he was overwhelmed by it. You know, he didn't expect to become the guardian. He said himself he expected maybe Abdu'l-Bahá would call upon him to organize the election of the House of Justice. Then he found out that he was the guardian, and he was overwhelmed by it. And he actually had to go away from Haifa to go to Switzerland and to reflect and to consider what happened. And he later told the story to Hand of the Cause Leroy Owas, and this, of course, is a pilgrim note, but he conveys a little bit about his feelings at the time. This is the report from Leroy Owas about that conversation. Leroy said, Shoghi Effendi was a very remarkable young man, and of course he just worshipped Abdu'l-Bahá. And when Abdu'l-Bahá passed away, the whole world became dark for him. All light had gone out. When he returned to the Holy Land, he had in mind from the things which Abdu'l-Bahá had said to him, and now I'm telling you what he said. He said, I had in mind that Abdu'l-Bahá would give me the honor of calling together the great conclave which would elect the Universal House of Justice. And I thought in his will and testament that that was probably what he was instructing should be done. But he said, instead of that, I found that I was appointed the guardian of the cause of God. I didn't want to be the guardian. In the first place, I didn't think I was worthy. In the next place, I didn't want to face these responsibilities. I didn't want to be the guardian. I knew what that meant. I knew that my life as a human being was over. He said, I didn't want it, and I didn't want to face it. So remember, I left the Holy Land and I went up to the mountains of Switzerland. And I fought with myself until I conquered myself. Then I came back and I turned myself over to God and I was the guardian. Now he said, every Baha'i in the world, every person in the world has to do exactly the same thing. Whether you are a hand of the cause, whether you are a knight of Baha'u'llah, whether you are a member of a national assembly, whether you are a teacher, whether you are a pioneer, whether you are an administrator, regardless of what you are, whatever you are doing in the cause, every Baha'i must fight with himself and conquer himself. And when he has conquered himself, then he becomes a true instrument for the service of the cause of God, and not until that. And he will not achieve as great a success until he has done it. And this is what every Baha'i in the world should know. This, friends, is our task if we're going to become these spiritual warriors that can fulfill our responsibility to exercise, to advance the divine plan. Now I conclude with these words of Shoghi Effendi. With hearts united, with minds purified, and with a determination never to waver or surrender, let us step into the arena of service and, armed with the sword of utterance and teaching, combat effectively the ills and sicknesses of this distracted world. Thank you very much, friends.